This is Setting the Record Straight. And I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. And we're brought to you on BreadboxMedia.com, especially for you. Several years ago, a nearby university had a conference called Science versus Religion. It was a 3-day conference. All sorts of speakers, renowned and not so renowned. And I went to a session or two. And I guess I was sort of shocked, because I saw not an intelligent discussion, but a lot of the myths about the Catholic Church and about Christianity were repeated as facts. There were people of all ages, but there were mainly students, and the auditorium was packed. And the line to the microphone to ask questions of the speakers was 100, 125. I didn't even attempt to get into the line. But I would have been a dissenting voice, that's for sure. Because the students were jeering at the Catholic Church. They were shaking their fists in anger and shouting at the supposed heirs of the Catholic Church, when they themselves were the one in error. They were in error about what the Catholic Church was and what its positions were and what its effects had been. They didn't even know the Catholic Church had created what they knew as science, as the scientific method. One could say they were ignorant, but they'd just never been taught that the Catholic Church was the organization that was the mother of science as they knew it. They jeered at the Catholic theologian. They had the false story about Galileo and his supposed persecution by the Catholic Church. Galileo and his supposed mistreatment was the great example cited over and over again in that conference. I'd say their criticisms were quite vehement about what these students saw as the Catholic Church's terrible attitude towards science and scientists. They saw all Christians, including Catholics, as creationists, bound to the literal interpretation of the Bible. What I saw was a great deal of ignorance, actually. Sorry to say. Let me say it again. Ignorance. I was deeply saddened as I drove home. This university was my alma mater. Not a pleasant thing to see. That same institution had damaged my belief, and I'd wandered outside the church for decades. You want to know how long? 40 years. 40 years of wandering. But I was active all that time, exploring the world's religions, flirting with atheism, flirting with Buddhism. All those years I kept imagining that the contrary claims of these various religions canceled them all out. They all mixed up into sort of a muddy thinking. You know, if you were to take up an artist's palette with its dabs of all the colors of the rainbow and many subtle tints, and mix them all together, you get something that is the color of mud. That's what I thought these religions did to each other. They all came down to sort of a confused base mud. Then as the years went on, I began to see that, no, these religions didn't cancel each other. In a way, they amplified each other. In a way, they strengthened each other. I came to see that. So I went on in my search, wayfaring around in various theologies, and I found there was nothing comparable to the Catholic Church. It towered above every other philosophical approach to the problems of man's existence, and way beyond that. The sheer effects of Catholicism upon human endeavor are just amazing. These effects exceeded anything that has happened anywhere else. It was an unbalanced picture. Catholicism towered above everything else in its effects, in art, literature, music, and politics. In each of those four areas, the effect of the Catholic Church was stunning. It was like a fertilizer growing the greatest art of any art in the world, sculpture and painting, the greatest music, all these great composers that we know from Western Europe, Beethoven, Schubert, Mozart, Haydn, were Catholics. Haydn was a daily communicant. Mozart sometimes was. Even Mahler converted to Catholicism and composed some deeply religious works. His 9 symphonies are favorites of mine. Then you consider literature, writing, novels, stories. The supremacy of Catholic literature is just stunning. But what about the field of science? That's the subject today. Well, the Catholic Church is the mother of science. Other civilization had technology, they had engineering. But the scientific method was developed within the Catholic Church by no one person. A lot of the credit goes to the Cathedral School at Chartres in France. A lot of the credit goes to Roger Bacon, the English Catholic monk. And that great scientist Galileo Galilei was a devout Catholic. His daughter was a nun. Their correspondence is really something wonderful to read. The theory of the solar system that Galileo propounded, that the planets revolved around the sun. You know it as the heliocentric theory. Galileo did not create that theory. He credited the man that created that theory. It was a Catholic cleric, a deacon. His name, you know, Nicola Copernicus. And the Big Bang Theory, which a great many of my British friends attribute to a British scientist who ridiculed the theory, calling it the Big Bang Theory, and the name stuck. But the real creator of that was a priest, Father Georges Lemaître, good friend of Einstein. Einstein became convinced that Father George was right. Well, all that is prelude to our subject today, which is really inspired by an article in First Things, one of my very favorite periodicals I subscribe. In the May 2016 issue, there was an article by William A. Wilson called Scientific Regress, I guess as opposed to progress. And William Wilson reveals to something that's very uncomfortable to learn. But in truth, I already knew it, because I have scientists in the family and friends that are scientists. And they've told me how much of modern science is fraudulent. So many of the articles in the peer-reviewed journals are just based on fraudulent science. It's disheartening. Perhaps there has been a loss of the adherence to truth and virtue in the hearts and souls of the individual scientists as they became progressively secular through time. And the poles of their souls shift from being magnetized by truth and God to being magnetized by worldly success. And virtue is lost. You think I'm exaggerating? Well, listen. Let me tell you something about what that article says. Wilson opens his article with his discussion. He says the problem with science is that so much of it simply isn't. Last summer, the Open Science Collaboration announced that it had tried to replicate 100 published psychological experiments, sampled from three of the most prestigious journals in the field. Scientific claims rest on the idea that experiments repeated under nearly identical conditions ought to yield approximately the same results. But until very recently, very few had bothered to check in a systematic way whether this was actually the case. The Open Science Collaboration, the OSC, was the biggest attempt yet to check a field's results, and the most shocking, actually. In many cases, they had used original experimental materials and sometimes performed the experiments under the guidance of the original researchers. Of the studies that had originally reported positive results, an astonishing 65% failed to show statistical significance on replication, and many of the remainder showed greatly reduced effect sizes. Their findings made the news, and quickly it became a club with which to bash the social sciences. But the problem isn't just with psychology. There's an unspoken rule in the pharmaceutical industry that half of all academic biomedical research will ultimately prove false. And in 2011, a group of researchers at Bayer decided to test it, looking at 67 recent drug discovery projects. Based on preclinical cancer biological research, they found that in more than 75% of cases, the published data did not match up with their in-house attempts to replicate. These were not studies published in fly-by-night oncology journals, but blockbuster research featured in Science, Nature, Cell, and publications like that. The Bayer researchers were drowning in bad studies, and it was to this in part that they attributed the mysteriously declining yields of drug pipelines. Perhaps so many of these new drugs failed to have an effect because the basic research on which their development was based justice invalid. When a study fails to replicate, there are two possible interpretations. The first is that unbeknownst to the investigators, there was a real difference in experimental setup between the original investigation and the failed replication. These are colloquially referred to as wallpaper effects, the joke being that the experiment was affected by the color of the wallpaper in the room. This is the happiest possible explanation for the failure to reproduce. It means that both experiments have revealed facts about the universe, and we now have the opportunity to learn what the difference was between them and to incorporate a new and subtler distinction into our theories. But what if that isn't so? The other interpretation is that the original finding was false. Unfortunately, an ingenious statistical argument shows that this second interpretation is far more likely. And since we're coming to a break, I won't get into it until after that break. So, if I'm asking for your patience with the intervening messages, please understand. This is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight on breadboxmedia.com. This music is The Hero Symphony by Philip Glass.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Yes, we're back after the break, talking about science and this disturbing realization that a lot of what is called science today isn't science at all. Let's go on with it. Before the break, we'd said that if a study attempting to replicate the original study doesn't produce the same result, maybe it's the result that the two different laboratories had different colored wallpaper. It's a joke, but not a joke. Sometimes subtle things can make big differences. But what if that's not so? That's a very comfortable explanation why these two studies differ. All the scientists involved in either effort were doing their very best as good truth-seeking scientists. But what if that's not so? The other interpretation is that the original finding was false. Unfortunately, an ingenious statistical argument shows that this second interpretation is far more likely. So what is this more uncomfortable alternative explanation? Well, there is a very plausible theory. First articulated by a man named John Ioannidis, a professor at Stanford University's School of Medicine. This argument proceeds by a simple application of Bayesian statistics. Suppose that there are 101 stones in a field. One of them has a diamond inside it, and luckily you have a diamond detecting device that advertises 99% accuracy. After an hour or so of moving the device around, examining each stone one after the other, examining each stone in turn, suddenly alarms flash and sirens wail, while the device is pointed at a promising-looking stone. What is the probability that the stone contains a diamond? Well, most would say if the device is 99% accurate, then there is a 99% chance that the device is correctly discerning a diamond, and a 1% chance that it is given a false positive reading. That would be nice. Consider this. Of the 101 stones in the field, only one is truly a diamond. Granted, our machine has a very high probability of correcting of correctly declaring it to be a diamond. But there are many more diamond freestones, and while the machine only has a 1% chance of falsely declaring each one of them to be a diamond, there are 100 of them. So if we were to wave the detector over every stone in the field, it would on average sound twice, once for the real diamond and once with a false reading, when a false reading was triggered by a stone that did not have a diamond in it. If we know only that the alarm is sounded, these two possibilities are equally probable, giving us an approximately 50% chance that the stone really contains a diamond. Not 99%, 50%. Now this is a simplified version of the argument that Ioannidis applies to the process of science itself. The stones in the fields are the set of all testable hypotheses. The diamond is a hypothesized connection or effect that happens to be true, and the diamond detecting device is the scientific method. A tremendous amount depends on the proportion of possible hypotheses which turn out to be true, and on the accuracy with which an experiment can discern truth from falsehood. Ioannidis shows that for a wider variety of scientific settings and fields, the values of these two parameters are not at all favorable. You know, you could take another example of this. Let's say, consider a team of molecular biologists investigating whether a mutation is one of the countless thousands of human genes that is linked to an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. The probability of a randomly selected mutation in a randomly selected gene having precisely that effect is quite low, is infinitesimally low. So just as with the stones in the fields, a positive finding is more likely than not to be incorrect, spurious. Unless the experiment is unbelievably successful at sorting the wheat from the chaff. So, Ioannidis finds that in many cases approaching even 50% true positives requires unimaginable accuracy. Unimaginable accuracy to even get to 50%. Hence, when he wrote a paper, he gave it a title that was, well, it was eye-catching. The title is, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. I wonder how that went over. Why most published research findings are false. You know, friend, what this makes me think? Makes me think that I'm going to look for another conference like that. Some university that's having a conference that says science versus religion. They don't really mean science. They mean scientism. The philosophy and beliefs behind science, not the objective science. But I'd like to go to another conference like that. Go better armed. This time I'd go with some comfortable shoes so I could stand in the line to ask questions long enough to bring this article up, to bring Ioannidis' study up. I wonder what they'd say. Who's objective now, I would say to them. Since you all are propounding scientism, the philosophy and beliefs that have been sort of decaled onto science, not really an integral part of it, just sort of stuck on it and going along for the ride. Scientism. What's your objectivity score for scientism? How do you think you would score on a scale of objectivity? What would your score be? I think Catholicism has a pretty good score compared to yours. Once you really know the history of the Catholic Church, and what it asserts to be true, and what it asserts to be probable, and what it asserts to be improbable, and what it asserts to be guesses. It makes you pretty proud of our objectivity and our ability to be skeptical about the things we say ourselves, and why perhaps the concept of the devil's advocate used to the Catholic Church to take findings that are favorable to the Catholic Church and challenge them with great vigor. The Church has made great use through the centuries of devil's advocates, of an office of devil's advocates, to be very skeptical about anything that they propound before establishing it as probably true. Maybe we're doing a better job of objectivity than they are. Makes you think that maybe the real objectivity may lay with the theologists, not with the scientists. Could be. Well, let's talk more about the dilemma that scientists are in. Let's talk about their respect for accuracy and their use of the term accuracy. Here, too, the news is not good. First, it is a de facto standard in many fields to use 1 in 20 as an acceptable cutoff for the rate of false positives. Now, to a naive ear, that may sound promising. Surely, it means that just 5% of scientific studies report a false positive? Is that what it means? But this is precisely the same mistake as thinking that a stone has a 99% chance of containing a diamond, just because the detector is sounded. What it really means is that for each of the countless false hypotheses that are contemplated by researchers, we accept a 5% chance that it will be falsely counted as true. Well, that's a decision with a considerably more deleterious effect on the proportion of correct studies. Well, a situation is actually made worse by the fact that a promising connection is often studied by several independent teams. Sort of a paradox. To see why, suppose that three groups of researchers are studying a certain phenomenon. And when all the data are analyzed, one group announces that it's discovered a connection. But the other two find nothing. No connection. Assuming that all the tests involved have a high statistical power, the lone positive finding is almost certainly the spurious one. However, when it comes time to report these findings, what happens? The teams that found a negative result, they didn't find anything, probably won't even bother to write up their non-discovery. After all, a report that a fanciful connection probably isn't true is not the sort of stuff of which scientific prizes are awarded, grant money. How about tenure decisions? You get tenure because you write up a non-discovery that a fanciful connection probably isn't true? You found no result?
But what if something else happens?
And what if they did write it up? It probably wouldn't be accepted for publication. Journals are in competition with one another for attention and impact factor, and are always more eager to report a new exciting finding than some killjoy of failure that didn't find an association. In fact, both of these effects can be quantified. Since the majority of all investigated hypotheses are false, if positive and negative evidence were written up and accepted for publication in equal proportion, then the majority of articles in scientific journals should report no findings. We didn't find anything. We don't find any connections. That would be the majority of the articles, because most hypotheses are false. But what do you find when you look at the journals who are in competition with one another to report positive findings, to say, hey, we find a connection? When tallies are actually made, though, the precise opposite turns out to be true. Nearly every published scientific article reports the presence of an association, of a finding, of a connection. You know, one starts to suspect that there must be a massive bias at work here. You know, you tell me, how do you get tenure without publishing a lot of good peer-reviewed articles showing positive results? How do you get scientific prizes and respect and awards? It's from finding associations and connections, not from finding none. So, you know what I'm certain of? I'm certain it's time for a break. And maybe you need a break. On Breadbox Media, I'm Chuck Coughlin, and we're setting the record straight.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to you after the break. I'm so glad to have you listening here. Let's go on with our discussion of why most scientific peer-reviewed articles are fraudulent. An unexpected, perhaps, conclusion. Recall what we were saying just before the break. What do you find when you look at the journals who are in competition with one another to report positive findings, to say, hey, we find a connection? When tallies are actually made, though, the precise opposite turns out to be true. Nearly every published scientific article reports the presence of an association, of a finding, of a connection. You know, one starts to suspect that there must be a massive bias at work here. You know, you tell me, how do you get tenure without publishing a lot of good peer-reviewed articles showing positive results? It reminds me of the story about Edison. I think it's probably true that he tried 10,000 different solutions to designing a good light bulb before he ended up with the one that worked. Actually, the one we're still using, and the majority of us are still using. Ioannidis' argument would be powerful even if all scientists were virtuous angels, motivated by the best of intention. But that's not what human beings are like. When the human element is considered, the picture actually becomes pretty dismal. Scientists have long been aware of something euphemistically called the experimenter effect. The experimenter effect. The curious fact is that when a phenomenon is investigated by a researcher who happens to believe in the phenomenon, it is more likely to be detected. Much of the effect can be, well, explained by researchers unconsciously giving hints or suggestions to their human or animal subjects, perhaps in something as subtle as body language or tone of voice. Even those scientists with the best of intentions and virtuous men and women have been caught fudging measurements or making small errors in rounding or statistical analysis that happen to give a more favorable result. Now, a lot of times this is just the result of an honest statistical error that leads to a desirable outcome. Therefore, it isn't considered as deliberate as it might have been had it pointed in the opposite direction. There's no putting it any nicer than this. Deliberate fraud is far more widespread than the scientific establishment is generally willing to admit. Well, one way we know there's a lot of fraud occurring is that if you phrase your question the right way, scientists will confess to it. In a survey of 2,000 research psychologists conducted, this was 2011, over half of those surveyed admitted outright to selectively reporting those experiments which gave the results that they were after, gave the results that they sought, gave what they imagined to be true in their hypothesizing. So then the investigators asked respondents anonymously to estimate how many of their fellow scientists had engaged in fraudulent behavior and promised them that the more accurate their guesses, the larger a contribution would be made to the charity of their choice. Well, they went through several rounds of anonymous guessing. The process was refined using the number of scientists who would admit their own fraud and other indirect measurements. The investigators finally concluded that around 10% of research psychologists engaged in outright falsification of data, and more than half have engaged in less brazen but still fraudulent behavior. What kind? Well, maybe reporting that a result was statistically different when it was not. Or deciding between two different data analysis techniques after looking at the results of each and choosing the one that produced the more favorable results, the result they want. Maybe more than half of those psychological researchers admitted to that. After all, data analysis is very much an art, more than an art than a science, and one that affords even its most scrupulous practitioners a wide degree of latitude. Should a subpopulation of the research sample with some common criterion be picked out and reanalyzed as if it were the totality? Cajoling the statistical significance, where in reality there is none, is a practice commonly known as p-hacking, the letter p-hacking. It's particularly easy to accomplish and difficult to detect on a case-by-case basis. Since the majority of studies still don't report the raw data along with their findings, maybe you didn't know that. They don't report the raw data along with their findings. So there's often nothing to reanalyze and check, even if there were volunteers with the time and inclination to do so. Somebody made a creative attempt to estimate how widespread this dishonesty really is, and that involved comparisons between fields
of various hardness, the hard sciences and the soft sciences. One man theorized that the farther from physics one gets, the more freedom creeps into one's experimental methodology, and the fewer constraints there are on a science's conscious and unconscious biases. If the softer sciences were more subject to biases, then we might expect that the social sciences have more papers that confirm a sought-after hypothesis than do the physical sciences, say with medicine and biology somewhere in the middle. There was a study of this, and that is exactly what the study discovered. A paper in psychology or psychiatry is about 5 times as likely to report a positive result as one in astrophysics. Now, this is not necessarily evidence that psychologists are all consciously or unconsciously manipulating their data. It could also be evidence of massive publication bias. If you want to get published, have a positive result. Well, either way you take it, the result is, let us say, disturbing. You know, while we're talking about physics, how do things go with this hardest of all hard sciences? Well, better than elsewhere, it would appear. And it's unsurprising that those who claim all is well in the world of science reach so reliably and so insistently for examples from physics, preferably physics of the most theoretical sorts.
In his First Things article, Wilson makes this observation.
Folk histories of physics combine borrowed mathematical luster and triumphalism in a way that journalists seem powerless to resist. The outcomes of physics experiments and astronomical observations seem, well, so matter of fact, so concrete, and so immediately connected to reality that they might let us gingerly sidestep all of these issues concerning sloppy analysis or motivations.
Well, guess what? This flight, this reaching for physics for justification, sort of gives the game away, makes us rather suspicious of what's really going on.
Since measured any way you like, volume of papers, number of working researchers, total amount of funding, deductive theory building physics in the mold of Newton and Lagrange, Maxwell and Einstein, is only a tiny fraction of modern science as a whole. In fact, it also makes up a tiny fraction of modern physics. That may surprise you.
So William A. Wilson makes this observation.
Far more common is the delicate and subtle art of scouring inconceivably vast volumes of noise with advanced software and mathematical tools in search of some tiny faint signal of some hypothesized but never before observed phenomenon. This sort of work is difficult. It's beautiful in its own way, but it's not at all self-evident in the matter of the really hard physical sciences, like a falling apple hitting Newton on the head or an elliptical planetary orbit.
So even this area of modern physics is susceptible to error.
So it's very sensitive to the same sort of accidental contamination. Well, deliberate fraud, too, and unconscious bias, just like the medical and social scientific studies we've discussed. You think the hard sciences don't make mistakes? Well, there is two. Two of the most vaunted physical results of the past few years. One was the announced discovery of both cosmic inflation and gravitational waves
at an experimental station in Antarctica.
That, and number two, the supposed discovery of superluminal neutrinos at the Swiss-Italian border. Both of these have now been retracted, and I can guarantee you it was retracted with far less fanfare in the press than when they were first published.
You've got to admit that a lot of defenders of the scientific establishment admit to these problems.
But then they continue with hymns to the self-correcting nature of the scientific method and the comforting fact that there is an objective reality after all. It's out there. And against that, we must test every theory. And that theory must withstand or fail. That means that all the sloppiness can be swept away by advances in the field. Well, that's the way the dogma goes. But these claims are rarely treated like hypotheses to be tested. Partisans of the new scientism, the belief in science, scientism, as distinct from science. So partisans of the new scientism are fond of recounting the so-called hoax.
You might remember the so-called hoax. It was covered in the media. S-O-K-A-L. The so-called hoax.
Though this is sort of infamous. There was a physicist, Alan Sokal, and he submitted a paper heavy on jargon, but full of false and meaningless statements, gibberish. It was submitted to the Postmodern Cultural Studies Journal Social text. Social text accepted the paper, published it without a quibble. But everyone is unlikely to mention a similar experiment conducted on reviewers of the prestigious British Medical Journal. The experimenters deliberately modified a paper to include 8 different major errors in study design methodology, data analysis, interpretation results. And not a single one of the 221 reviewers who participated caught all of the errors. On the average, they caught fewer than 2. And unbelievably, these results held up even in the subset of reviewers who had been specifically warned that they were participating in a study, and there must be something a little odd in the paper that they were reviewing. In summary, only 30% of reviewers recommended that the intentionally flawed paper be rejected. Only 30% recommended that it be rejected. And it contained major errors, purposeful errors. So what good is peer review? It appears to be really good at keeping unpopular ideas from being published.
Well, it's time for a break. I'll be right back in a few moments.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
On redboxmedia.com, we've been setting the record straight about the state of science today and the rather shoddy state of scientific publications today, which have a high percentage of fraud or just carelessness. And this has been documented in the wonderful periodical First Things in an article called Scientific Regress by William A. Wilson. You ought to take a look at the entire article. You'll find it in the May 2016 issue of First Things, wonderful periodical. So in the last segment, we were talking about various studies of these articles and how accurate were they and what was the percent of them that could not be replicated or there was evidence of fraud or just carelessness in it. So we're going to talk about those studies a little more. Consider the finding of another study, this time from a group of cancer researchers. In addition to reaching the now unsurprising conclusion that only a dismal 11% of the preclinical cancer research they examined could be validated after the fact, the authors identified another horrifying pattern. The so-called bad papers that failed to replicate were, on the average, cited far more often than the papers that were able to be replicated. As the authors put it, and this is a quote, some non-reproducible preclinical papers had spawned an entire field with hundreds of secondary publications that expanded on elements of the original observation, but did not actually seek to confirm or falsify its fundamental basis, unquote. Well, what does this mean? This means that once an entire field is being created, careers, funding, appointments, prestiged, all premised, founded on an experimental result, which was utterly false, pointed to this fact, and it's a fact that's not likely to be very popular. Peer review can progress from being merely useless to being actively harmful. It may be ineffective in keeping papers with analysis or methodological flaws from being published, but it can be deadly effective at suppressing criticism of the dominant research paradigm, of the dominant research beliefs, of the dominant scientism. Even if a critic is able to get his work published, pointing out that the house you've built together is situated over a chasm will not endear him to his colleagues, or more importantly,
to his mentor, or especially to his financial patrons.
Consider the finding of another study, this time from a group of cancer researchers. In addition to reaching the now unsurprising conclusion that only a dismal 11% of the preclinical cancer research they examined could be validated after the fact, the authors identified another horrifying pattern. The so-called bad papers that failed to replicate were, on the average, cited far more often than the papers that were able to be replicated. As the authors put it, and this is a quote, some non-reproducible preclinical papers had spawned an entire field with hundreds of secondary publications that expanded on elements of the original observation, but did not actually seek to confirm or falsify its fundamental basis, unquote. Well, what does this mean? This means that once an entire field is being created, careers, funding, appointments, prestiged, all premised, founded on an experimental result, which was utterly false, pointed to this fact, and if it's a fact that's not likely to be very popular, peer review can progress from being merely useless to being actively harmful. It may be ineffective in keeping papers with analysis or methodological flaws from being published, but it can be deadly effective at suppressing criticism of the dominant research paradigm, of the dominant research beliefs, of the dominant scientism. Even if a critic is able to get his work published, pointing out that the house you've built together is situated over a chasm will not endear him to his colleagues, or more importantly,
to his mentor, or especially to his financial patrons.
So whole institutions can be created, and careers and house mortgages, and children that need braces and the dentist must be paid, develop around theories that haven't ever been replicated. And the investment into continuing to prop up that theory has become bound together with the career scientist's necessity of propping up his own lifestyle. What's really bothersome about this is that older scientists are the most likely to be invested in the existing research paradigm, whatever it is, even if it's based upon an old experiment that has never successfully been replicated. The quantum physicist Max Planck famously quipped, quote, "A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and by making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grew up that is familiar with it." William A. Wilson thinks Planck may have been too optimistic. There was a recent paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research that studied what happened to scientific subfields when star researchers die suddenly at the peak of their abilities. It found that while there is considerable evidence that young researchers are reluctant to challenge scientific superstars, a sudden and unexpected death does not significantly improve the situation, particularly when the key collaborators of the star are in a position to channel resources such as editorial goodwill or funding to the insiders. There's another heretical philosopher of science, Paul Feyerabend, who on the other hand claimed that new theories frequently contradict the best available evidence, at least at first. Often the old observations were inaccurate or irrelevant, and it was the invention of a new theory that stimulated experimentalists to go on hunting for new observational techniques. Now in Wilson's article, which is entitled Scientific Regress, what he's referring to is this. The raw results of science are often false. The filtering mechanisms are often so ineffective. And the self-correcting mechanisms are now so compromised and slow that science's approach to truth may not even be effective. In other words, past theories, now refuted by evidence and replaced with new approaches, may be closer to the truth than we think now. Such scientific regress has happened before. In the 19th century, the correct vitamin C deficiency theory of scurvy was replaced by the new belief, a false one, that scurvy was caused by proximity to spoiled foods. Certainly ours is a world in which things once known, for certain, can be lost and buried. And we're doing a great deal of research. We have an unremitting flood of new, actually mostly false results that are pouring in faster and faster. Too fast for the defective truth-discerning mechanism of science to operate, perhaps? Well, we have an ever larger thicket of baseless theories, such that the proportion of true scientific beliefs shrinks as a percentage, even as the absolute number of them continues to rise. The South American author Borges wrote a book about the Library of Babel, which contained every true book that could ever be written. But the library was useless, because it also contained every false book. Both true and false were lost within an ocean of nonsense. So this is an odd moment in which we live, with our bloated scientific bureaucracy churning out masses of research results. According to Wilson's article in First Things, he believes
that most of these results are outright false. When a formerly ascetic discipline like science suddenly attains a measure of influence, it is bound to be flooded by opportunists and charlatans, whether it's the National Academy of Science or the Monastery of Cluny. That's not an outrageous comparison. Like monasticism, science is an enterprise with a superhuman aim, whose achievement is ever beyond the limited capacities of the flawed, simple human beings who labor toward that goal. The best scientists know that they must practice a sort of mortification of the ego, a cultivated dispassion that allows them to report their findings, even when those findings might mean the dashing of hopes, the drying up of financial resources, to say nothing of no money to pay the dentist bill. It should be no surprise that even after outgrowing the monasteries, the practice of science has attracted souls driven to seek the truth regardless of personal cost and despite, for most of its history, a distinct lack of financial or status reward. While science, and really science bureaucracy, is a career, careers attract careerists. The more you reflect on this, the more you can see that the best scientists often, like the best soldiers, were scientists of Christ, the monks, the ascetics, who cared for other things, but far less than they cared for the pursuit of truth. That's why science, real science, the scientific method, arose within monasteries and cathedral schools. That's why it was the monk Roger Bacon, who's often given credit for the scientific method. Once again, Catholicism has proved to be the world's most fertile garden of benefits, earthly benefits to mankind. Apparently, the qualities of humility and the practice of asceticism can be very productive when one's searching for the truth. If science wasn't prepared for the influx of careerists, it was even less prepared for the blossoming of the cult of science. The cult is the cult of scientism. Both the adherents of scientism and careerists both have a tendency to treat the body of scientific knowledge as a holy book or a religious revelation that offers simple and quite decisive resolutions to very deep questions. Rather, cult leadership trends heavily in the directions of educators, popularizers, and journalists. At its best, science is a human enterprise with a superhuman aim, a task fit for Catholic monks and the very remarkable asceticism of the Catholic knights of the Middle Ages. So we've seen so many examples how the human element of the scientific enterprise harms and damages its progress. Wilson ends his article by saying, "When a prevailing culture attempts to render science a sort of clericalism without the religion, scientists often forget that they're made of the same crooked timber as the rest of humanity, and that crookedness will imperil the work that they do." This is Chuck Coughlin, hoping to play the Catholic devil's advocate, applying a humble skepticism to the modern cult of scientism. You're on breadboxmedia.com.